about 20% from the year 2020 to 2021. The vast majority of those injuries were considered serious. Amazon says the increase in injuries is due in part to an increase in hiring during the pandemic. Amazon pledged last year to become, quote, Earth's safest place to work, end quote. Oklahoma's Republican Governor Kevin Stitt signed a bill into law yesterday that makes it a felony to perform an abortion procedure. The bill sets a maximum punishment of 10 years in prison and a $100,000 fine for those who perform the procedure, only making an exception for when an abortion could save the life of the pregnant person. The law does not create criminal penalties for people receiving an abortion. During a signing ceremony, Stitt said his goal is to, quote, outlaw abortion in the state of Oklahoma, and promised to, quote, sign every pro-life bill that hits my desk, end quote. Reproductive rights advocates promised a legal challenge to the law. And Georgia's Republican Governor Brian Kemp signed a bill into law yesterday that makes it legal for most residents to carry a concealed firearm without a license. Georgia now becomes the 25th state with some type of constitutional carry law. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 83 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 68 degrees with fair skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Indigenous peoples have been on the front lines protecting the planet from environmental devastation. They are also part of frontline communities severely impacted by exploitation of Mother Earth and have asked that we have another relationship with nature. And they have made significant gains. In September of 2021, the Indigenous Environmental Network and Oil Change International released a report entitled Indigenous Resistance Against Carbon. The report analyzes the impact Indigenous resistance to fossil fuel projects in the United States and Canada has had on greenhouse gas emissions over the last 10 years. According to the report, Indigenous resistance has stopped or delayed greenhouse gas pollution equivalent to at least 25% of annual U.S. and Canadian emissions. Indeed, Indigenous peoples have long led the fight to protect Mother Earth, and many say the only way forward is to center Indigenous knowledge and keep fossil fuels in the ground. Not only have Indigenous peoples directly confronted climate change head-on, most often putting their lives on the line, they, along with the Global Justice Ecology Project and other grassroots environmental campaigners from frontline communities, have for decades been raising alarms about false climate solutions. They've pointed out that these false climate solutions not only provide superficial and cosmetic changes to what are urgent and systemic problems, but a lot more. Indigenous and other environmental campaigners continue to speak out against these false solutions. This, as we're facing what is increasingly referred to as a climate catastrophe. A coalition of grassroots Indigenous and environmental movements have released a new third edition of a report entitled Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, Resist False Solutions to Climate Change. It is an easy-to-read, concise, yet comprehensive report of the false corporate promises, which its authors say lead us down risky pathways, poised to waste billions of public dollars on a host of corporate schemes and market-based mechanisms. Hoodwinked in the Hothouse provides a robust framework for understanding the depth of real solutions and how they could be determined, rooted in pro-Indigenous, pro-environment, and anti-capitalist thought. Previous editions of Hoodwinked in the Hothouse played a major role in raising awareness across climate movements around the world, both helping frontline organizers in their campaigns against destructive energy proposal and shifting policy positions of large non-governmental organizations. Today, on Sojourner Truth, we have permission to bring you part one of our two-part Hoodwinked in the Hothouse series, featuring an international panel of climate justice organizers and frontline community leaders. The speakers include Ariel Chakwe Duranje, Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action, Jackie Patterson of the Chisholm Legacy Project, Monica DeOro of Micronesia Climate Justice Alliance, and Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. They discuss the new Hoodwinked in the Hothouse report, as well as the multi-billion dollar climate investments being promoted by fossil fuel industries and other disaster capitalists. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding.
We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headline.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The presidents of Poland and three Baltic nations have arrived in Ukraine to discuss aid for the country in its fight against Russian invaders. The German president had planned to attend, but was apparently left off the guest list. More from Feature Story News' Rosie Burchard in Brussels.
Lithuanian President Gitanas Nausėda says he's bringing a message of further political support and military assistance to Kyiv during his visit, alongside his Polish and Baltic counterparts. But that's a message German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier won't be delivering in person, as his plans to take part in the trip were rebuffed by Ukraine. Speaking to press on Tuesday, Steinmeier said he was ready to join the visit, but that was something Kyiv did not want. In the past, the German president has been criticized for closeness with Russia, but Steinmeier has also spoken publicly about what he calls mistakes in Berlin's past approach to relations with Moscow. Rosie Burchard, Brussels.
Ukraine is disputing a Russian report that it has captured more than 1,000 Ukrainian soldiers in the besieged southeastern port of Mariupol. Ukrainian presidential adviser Oleksiy Arestovych did not comment on the alleged surrender. Ukrainian officials say the city remains under their control. Thousands of civilians have been reported killed in the city during the Russian assault. The actual number is expected to be far higher. Meanwhile, a group of Ukrainian Marines in Mariupol, who had been cut off from other Ukrainian units, has been able to reestablish contact. President Biden on Tuesday called Russia's actions in Ukraine a genocide for the first time. But White House officials say U.S. policy toward Russia will not change. Biden said the U.S. will continue to work with allies to investigate apparent war crimes committed by Russian forces in northern Ukraine. Biden made the charge in apparently off-the-cuff remarks in Iowa, where he had promised to ease restrictions on ethanol-infused gasoline to help lower gas prices. Christopher Martinez has more.
Biden partially blamed Russia's invasion of Ukraine for sparking inflation and rising gas prices. And in saying that, Biden, for the first time, used language that appears to call Russian atrocities in Ukraine genocide, a term that administration officials have avoided using up to now.
Your family budget, your ability to fill up your tank, none of it should hinge on whether a dictator declares war and commits genocide in a half a world away.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
New York City police say a man sought in connection with an attack on a subway train in Brooklyn Tuesday that left 10 people shot is now considered a suspect. Investigators had initially been searching for 62-year-old Frank R. James as a person of interest. Police said that they found keys at the scene to a U-Haul van rented by James in Philadelphia. Authorities were examining social media videos in which James decried the U.S. as a racist place, awash in violence, and sometimes railed against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Adams told CNN today that the Brooklyn subway shooting is just the latest example of gun laws in the country that are far too lax.
We have an overproliferation of guns in our city and in our country. New York Police Department took 1,800 guns off the street in the 3.5 months that I have been the mayor. We need to think about that for a moment. Why they continue to flow into our city.
Police said the gunman sent off smoke grenades in a crowded subway car and then fired at least 33 shots with a 9mm handgun. 5 gunshot victims were in critical condition, but all 10 wounded in the shooting were expected to survive. At least a dozen others who escaped gunshot wounds were treated for smoke inhalation and other injuries. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp signed a bill into law Tuesday allowing residents to carry handguns in public without a license or background check. The governor signed a second measure that gives concealed weapons permit holders from other states the ability to carry legally in Georgia as well. The Georgia Senate passed what supporters call the Constitutional Carry Act at the beginning of April, sending it to the governor's desk. Standing in front of a crowd of supporters outside Gable Sporting Goods in Douglasville, Kemp said the bill is a public safety measure. During his 2018 campaign for governor, Kemp promised to champion the legislation, but little was done to advance it. The measure was revived this year, now that Kemp faces opposition in this year's primary from former U.S. Republican Senator David Perdue and others. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
We kick off part one of the special Hoodwinked in the Hot House, Resist False Solutions to Climate Change, bringing you voices from an international panel of climate justice organizers and frontline community leaders. They discuss the new Hoodwinked in the Hot House report, an easy-to-read, concise yet comprehensive report of the false corporate promises being promoted by multinational organizations and corporations. They also discuss strategies for real solutions to climate change rooted in pro-Indigenous, pro-environment, and anti-capitalist thought. Panelists include Chikwe Diranje, Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action, Jackie Patterson of the Chisholm Legacy Project, and Monieka Deoro of Micronesia Climate Justice Alliance, and Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Let's hear from them now.
Thank you for the invitation, not only for myself, but for the other speakers on this panel. I was asked to do some grounding. I said I prefer not to say a prayer in my language, but to give some words to all the participants who are taking part in this panel, but also who are listening. Is the greetings in my mom's Dene language, Yate'e. Greetings and Haumidakia P on my Dakota side. And we always greet people in that way. We're told as far as when we come together as people is that we come together as relations, as relatives. We are all part of the two-legged human people. And part of the Five Finger Clan. Haumidakia P, once again, all my relations. Empetu Kede, Chante Washte, Iyuha Nape Chiyuzapido. From the goodness of my heart, I shake all of your hands. And in this presentation of talking about the false solutions of climate change, from our indigenous perspective and many of the spiritual leaders that I personally have worked with, and our staff, our members, all come from community. We are a grassroots indigenous environmental network, and woven into that network, our families, our people who have strong convictions on our traditional beliefs, our original instructions. And we've been told years ago that we have to start sharing these teachings. And where it became very evident is in this discussion of Mother Earth, Father Sky, and climate change. So if people can just kind of think about these words of the question of how do you walk on that sacredness of the female creative principle of Mother Earth? How do you walk on Mother Earth? When you breathe the air of life, when you drink the water of life, when you touch our brothers and sisters of the trees of the forest nation, when you walk through the grasslands, when you go into the mountain regions or where there are glaciers and you taste the melting waters, or you go out into the ecosystem and you meet our four-legged brothers and sisters, or the bird nation, the insects, the ones that are in the ground, the fish. What is that relationship that you have with nature? What is that relationship that you've been instructed to believe in since you were born into this world? Many of our people and our families and our tribal and our indigenous communities are taught about that relationship when we are brought into this world in that release of the water of life from our mothers, to that first breath that we take in that relationship, a sacred relationship with Grandmother Earth, with Mother Earth, with our Father Sky. And this is what guides us. This is what guides us as many of our indigenous peoples. So that's why in this presentation, we ask that there be a grounding of understanding of how we walk on Mother Earth. Thank you. Itakie Owasi.
Tlasokamati, Tom, many thanks for that beautiful grounding. I will now proceed to introduce the event. Hoodwinked in the hothouse, examining false corporate schemes being advanced through the Paris Agreement, and we must add in the NYC Climate Week events that are happening at the moment. From net zero emissions and carbon capture to nature-based solutions and geoengineering, a number of neoliberal and, should we say, the continuously colonial policy agendas and unproven corporate techno-fixes continue to subsidize the expansion of fossil fuel industries while further impacting communities on the front lines of climate chaos. In response to the NYC Climate Week, and as we head into the UN Climate Conference, COP26, where the implementation of the Paris Agreement will be negotiated, climate justice advocacy groups and social movements are faced with overcoming a complex array of these false schemes in order to force institutions towards a decolonizing, post-capitalist, anti-patriarchal, just transition framework that could seriously tackle the roots of the crisis, a framework that is rooted on indigenous and regenerative principles of environmental justice. This event would not be possible without the amazing coordination that led to the production of the Hoodwinked in the Hothouse report, a large a coalition of organizations that are deeply involved with grassroots climate justice movements throughout the world, whose work is indispensable in centering the key issue areas in today's climate struggles. Biofuel Watch, Energy Justice Network, ETC Group, Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives, Indigenous Climate Action, Indigenous Environmental Network, Just Transition Alliance, La Via Campesina, Movement Generation, Mount Diablo Rising Tide, Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, North American Megadam Resistance Alliance, Nuclear Information and Resource Service, Rising Tide North America, and Shaping Change Collaborative. Now, I'd like to move us to welcome our panelists to this event. Ariel Duranger from Indigenous Climate Action, Jackie Batterson from Chisholm Legacy Project, Muñeca de Oro from Micronesia Climate Justice Alliance, of course, Tom Galtooth from Indigenous Environmental Network, and our host, Ananda Lee Tan from Just Transition Alliance. Following this introduction, I will cede the mic to Ananda, who will provide some context for this panel and guiding questions that will be followed by contributions from our panelists. We will then finish with a segment of questions and answers, which will be based on a selection of questions submitted by the audience in written form across the different platforms. We have other organizations to thank. We cannot mention all of them here. This event has been possible thanks to the support of the team of the New School at the Environmental Policy and Sustainability Management Program, the Indigenous Resurgence, Decolonization, and Sustainability Initiative of the Tishman Environment and Design Center, Amazon Watch, in addition to the organizations who were centerpiece to this initiative, such as the Indigenous Environmental Network, the Just Transition Alliance, Global Justice Ecology Project, and Biofuel Watch. With that, I'd like to pass the floor to Ananda. Thanks, Ananda.
Thanks, Leo, and thanks, Tom, and thanks everyone who's been able to join this webinar. It's truly an honor for me to be the moderator on a panel of not only such amazing, inspiring organizers and movement leaders, but also people I consider family, people who are my people, who we've been working together for many years now, mentors, peers, young leadership that is coming up. And I'll introduce them a bit more in detail, but I'll start off with some of the context that I agreed to provide in the lead into this conversation and this moment. And I'll ask our panelists to reflect on this later. Is really why, you know, why should we be concerned? You know, what's really happening? How are we being hoodwinked in the hothouse? Just to note that this is a third edition of Hoodwinked. It was a collaboration for the first two editions. The last edition that I know at least Tom and I worked on, possibly a number of you worked on, and many others on this call, was produced in the lead up to the Copenhagen Climate Conference in 2009. And at that time, it was very important because in many countries, starting with the U.S., the UN's Kyoto Protocol had started driving domestic legislation towards carbon market mechanisms, the idea that we could, through pricing pollution and creating opportunities for the world's largest polluters to then come up with ways in which to reduce greenhouse gas emissions through market-based mechanisms and technology investments, that we could address the climate crises, that we started to really actively coordinate and a popular education response to really inquiring why these technocratic neoliberal policy options were really problematic. And it has a longer history that I'll ask our brother Tom to reflect on later, but it really goes back to the inception of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change in the first place, of how such a assembly of the League of Nations, you know, for many of us in this day and age are starting to recognize that it remains an incomplete assembly, because it actually does not include the oldest living nations, you know, of this earth, all the indigenous communities that live around the earth and that can really provide us guidance in this moment of ecological crises are not at the table as full participants. How can the League of Nations or the UN itself take on the responsibility to provide this global strategy? It needs to be called into question. But underneath that, what has been advanced, starting with the Kyoto Protocol, which is really the world's first carbon market mechanism. And if for some of you veterans, you may remember that Al Gore only, the U.S. delegation only agreed to signing Kyoto Call after it centered a carbon market mechanism, the Clean Development Mechanism, which then for many years afterwards served to subsidize massive problematic polluting industries and frontline communities around the world, with landfill gas and incinerator projects in places like India and Brazil, to landfill, you know, displacement of workers, to the displacement of indigenous peoples from their lands, to forced carbon offsets regimes, to a whole host of other frontline community impacts. This clean development mechanism really set us up to actually move in the wrong direction. you know, ended up being the probably the world's largest, what we call these days, perverse subsidies, policy subsidies for those destroying the earth. In that context, and since then, there's been a whole host of other institutions in the U.S., namely the California Global Warming Solutions Act, which produced the California carbon trading mechanism, and various other voluntary trading mechanisms, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative on the East Coast of the United States, and a whole host of other carbon market mechanisms around the world that really, in many of our views, subsidize the polluters to actually add more burden on primarily frontline communities, primarily indigenous, black, brown, migrant, and poor communities who are already suffering the first and most, the worst impacts of climate change. Those on the front lines of the fires, the droughts, the storms, the floods, but also on the front lines of the toxic pollution burdens, of the police and prison industrial complex violence that maintain the hegemony of these corporate polluters, and a whole other series of systemic systems of violence that have oppressed primarily indigenous and people of color and poor communities around the world. So in that context, it's more germane than ever that we continue fighting this agenda, this corporate agenda, to hijack harm, to opportunistically try to profiteer off the suffering of millions around the world, and further entrench the systemic racism, the systemic patriarchy, the systemic violence that's levied at the communities that we organize in. And so in that context, what today we're hoping to do is really give you a sort of a more detailed examination of how that agenda has prevailed, has continued from the Paris Agreement to the current day negotiations, and how through the implementation of the Paris Agreement in the at the upcoming, or the negotiations about the implementation of the agreement that are going to take place in Scotland, in Glasgow at COP26, how some of those threads have actually, you know, threatened to take us in the direction we cannot afford to go. In this time of Anthropocene, in this time of recognizing we humanity has created the largest ecological crisis, the sixth great extinction, some are calling it, that there are some, you know, amongst us who actually shoulder the major burden of responsibility for driving this crisis. Those that are making billions of dollars at the expense of others, as we've seen through this pandemic, but also those who still continue to have the most influence in government. Those who are driving the Biden administration to now look at options like carbon capture and sequestration and further entrench nuclear power and waste at the cost of people's lives. Those institutions are now at the table. And in this moment, where in the lead up to the Glasgow Climate Conference, where there's a real serious concern about the equity and even participation of our comrades from the global south who do not have access to vaccination programs because of the inequity of the pharmaceutical complexes, have not, and patenting and all kinds of other restrictions, have not had access to immunization programs that would allow their social movements, their delegates, the people that should be attending, the people who are also on the front lines of this crisis, have relegated them to a backseat. You know, even if they were to participate by Zoom, you know, realizing the fact that those who are destroying the planet and those who are profiting most from it are going to have the front and center position in deciding what the global compact is going to do in the coming years. This is something that we requires not only a deep systemic challenge or a challenge of the deep systemic inequities, but really a clear understanding across our movements, across all the environmental groups that are advocating and organizing for climate change, that are trying to find new streams of funding and trying to create philanthropic support for these movements, of folks who are working on policy, folks who are fighting climate change and building the resilience of their communities on the ground. It requires a coordinated effort and a shared understanding of how we navigate this problem, how we tear these policy tables away from some of these neoliberal policy pathways and agendas and actually move towards the solutions we need.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a quick station break. When we return, we'll continue with part one of this special, Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, Resist False Solutions to Climate Change. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Sojourner Truth, and you can check us out on our website on sotrueradio.org. If you are a member of Facebook, you can look for us there and like us. You can also follow us on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle is @SoTrueRadio. We're also nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. You can go to the search bar and type in Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott to find us. And today we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Indigenous lands in the Americas, and internationally, we'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Spain. Now we return to our special, Hoodwinked in the Hothouse, Resist False Solutions to Climate Change. During the second half of our program, you will hear more from an international panel of climate justice organizers and frontline community organizers. They include Chakwe Duranje, Executive Director of Indigenous Climate Action, Jackie Patterson of the Chisholm Legacy Project, Monica De Oro of Micronesia Climate Justice Alliance, and Tom Goldtooth, Executive Director of the Indigenous Environmental Network. Let's hear from them now.
It's a pleasure to have Jackie, Ariel, Monica, and Tom here. I'll start with Tom because, in my culture, acknowledging our elders and those who have provided us mentorship is key. And Tom is someone I've had, there's very few people I openly call a mentor, but Tom is someone I've learned from over the years, over the decades, his wisdom, his foresight, but also his persistence, a principle of practice. Tom is someone who's always reminded me that we need to be inclusive of everyone, especially those voices who are not represented. And as a veteran environmental justice organizer, pointed us to those principles of really centering the voices of those first and most impacted, and next ensuring that nobody is excluded. In early days of forming the Climate Justice Alliance or at other environmental justice initiatives, Tom has always raised the fact that we shouldn't forget our poor white brothers and sisters in Appalachia or those working class communities. Just because they're white communities, we should make sure to an extra effort to sometimes include them when we have our EJ gatherings, or making sure that we have balance that community, not just the NGOs with privilege, but also those without paid staff are included. This is something that, for me, has provided really important guidance. So, Tom, thank you for joining us. And I will. I wondered if you would share some opening reflections on the relevance of Hoodwinked and this examination of corporate false solutions today.
Sure. Thank you, Ananda. You did a really good introduction on Hoodwinked. And as you were talking, I was thinking about the 26 years that have gone by since the United Nations Earth Summit back in 1992, that it adopted the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change as a process for the world governments to come together to address climate change. And so here we are, a number of us are making plans on the road to Glasgow, Scotland for the 26th Conference of the Parties. Conference of the Parties meaning the nation states, the governments who are party to this UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. It's been a long road. I got involved in 1998 coming out of a native-based summit in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and got mandates from there, from traditional people, spiritual leaders, women's societies, youth, and some of our tribal governments programs that were concerned about climate change. And we sent a document, we prepared a document that is our mandate and has been something that we've built upon as we started to participate in these climate meetings. And I remember when Orrin Lyons is one of our elders and faith keepers from the Haudenosaunee Confederacy out east of me, he said within their confederacy, they prophesize that the time will come when the trees start dying from the top down. And so they translated that into the change in climate and said that we need to get involved as indigenous peoples. So, you know, since that time, I like to report that there's been a lot of successes, and there have been some of that. You know, as far as industrialized countries of the North who have played a lot of power politics in the negotiations, you know, the amount of emission reductions, it has not ever been met. The Kyoto Protocol you mentioned that was signed in 1997, that was very moderate. It was in a way, once I got familiar with the greenhouse effect and that, it wasn't even near to where we needed to get. But during the 26 years going to the COP, emissions from fossil fuels, from the burning of fossil fuels and the mining, the extraction of fossil fuels, it continues to rise, especially with the industrialized countries that share the main responsibility for the increase in atmospheric emissions. That's why, you know, for us in our movement as indigenous peoples, we started to come together with the Global South and the Black and people of color and poor communities in this country, but also in the Global South, around looking at the issues around who is responsible for addressing this issue, who has contributed the most and created this climate debt, you could say, ecosystems debt. Also looking at economic justice and economic debt that is very critical. So since then, we all have said, I think it's not new to the listening audience, that when we say that the UN meeting has been taken over by the corporations, we realize that it's been more about negotiations of business more than regulation. So there's a lot of popularity. I'm not going to go in depth with that. Breakdown of the road to the 2015 Paris Agreement as part of the UN climate meetings. But from, I need to say, from our Indigenous Environmental Network and standing with the analysis of our brothers and sisters from the South, we say that the result of this UN Paris Agreement is that it's a trade agreement. It's nothing more. It's not a climate agreement. It's a trade agreement. It promises to privatize, to commodify, and to sell forested lands as carbon offsets, proving a financial laundering mechanism for rich developed countries and the corporations, the polluting corporations of the North, to launder their carbon pollution on the backs of the Global South, and in the North, on the backs of our indigenous Black and people of color and low-income communities. We know this. But it's surprising that a lot of the general society, the public in the North, Canada, United States, and civil society throughout the world haven't put that together. That's why it was very important for us to come together and to produce the third version of this Hoodwinked in the Hot House publication with the goal to demystify carbon markets, carbon pricing, geoengineering technologies, and extreme energy developments, such as mega hydro dams, for an example, nuclear energy, and there's a lot of other forms of energy that's being proposed that is not clean, it's not, and it's destructive. So we've seen a dangerous slide since our participation, since I've been going into the hallways of these UN climate meetings. It's a slide towards a lawless capitalism. I like to say it isn't, but it's where this free market ideology, neoliberalism, is privatizing every aspect of our lives, and virtually there's no public oversight to this, no accountability of their profiteering. That's how serious this issue is, and why we found as Indigenous peoples that we need to wake up the world. Somehow the world has lost that relationship to the sacredness of Mother Earth and Father Sky, and that we feel that Mother Earth is not for sale. The sky is not for sale. So part of the politics around climate change that we're seeing here domestically in the United States, including our sisters to have to deal with the same politics in Canada and throughout the world, is a politics of desperation. We see that not only within the environmental and climate movements, the non-governmental organizations, but also politicians and the foundations and funders. And it's just that in a lot of this work, you know, we have used the word disaster capitalism tied with the short-sightedness of carbon and techno-fundamentalism that's driving this corporate false promises. And I wanted to just share a couple of these thoughts with you to start out this discussion. And even the flooding of big money from philanthropocapitalists such as Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, and Elon Musk, who are pushing false solutions, especially within geoengineering technologies such as carbon capture and storage and solar radiation management. So how do we convey this to our young people, to society, so that they can become aware of what's really happening when we talk about climate policy and how to mitigate and adapt to a changing climate. Our concern, for an example, with these funders, they sourced up to a tune of $100 million some of the major NGOs that are fighting us when we speak the truth on how these false solutions do not cut admissions at the source that we need. So we ask you to download, to get a copy of Hoodwinked, and you'll see a whole package of exposures of this climate investment schemes. And it's like Ananda said, it's designed to reward the profiteers, who are the very folks that are causing the problem and the pollution. And I want to say, you know, with the related to our traditional knowledge, is that at least those people that have guided me says, when I explain this whole process of the carbon offsets, for an example, carbon markets, cap and trade, carbon tax, I explained it and break it down to a lot of spiritual leaderships, not only in the North, but in the South. And they say, it's not right. How can we put a price to the air? How can we include the air like carbon and methane and greenhouse gases into a modern market system and treat it as a commodity? Before you trade air, for an example, you got to determine whose property right it is. So it's a legal system of privatization. And for any of our folks that want to participate in these systems, I ask the question, how do you reconcile participation in these false solutions that commodify and privatizes Mother Earth and nature? We've started to work on one area way back in the early 2000s on reducing emissions from deforestation and degradation. It was a carbon offset initiative that still is continuing, called RED. It's where in polluting industry, like, for an example, Chevron or Shell, who pollute in California, they can offset their pollution locally by going carbon neutral, buying carbon credits to protect the trees in the Amazon. Sure, we want to do everything we can to protect the trees of our brothers and sisters, but in these false solutions, using trees as carbon sponges, as scams that really allow the polluters to continue to pollute in the North, creating toxic hotspots. That's wrong. That's wrong. So now we're seeing a rebranding of the organizing that we did amongst many different organizations throughout the world to expose like RED as being a scam. They rebranded it. Now it's called Nature-Based Solutions, Nature-Based Solutions. And my other final comment on these is that we have to really be educated on everything that's happening as people from the U.S., people from different countries, civil society that still is having a hard time getting into the COP. That's a big concern as well. We're very cautious on Green New Deal governmental initiatives as being part of green economy scams. So these are where we have to be alert. We got to have the capacity to really look through these smoke screens and speak out, such again as nature-based solutions or natural climate solutions, and using terms such as regenerative agriculture. Check these out, where they're using soil now and the carbon in the soil. But whose money is that? That money comes from the polluters again as an offset for their pollution. So this is where we want to share this information with you. The Hoodwink booklet is very, very helpful towards that. And, you know, and this whole process that's taken place and this worldview, how the world uses machines to make meaning of life, where Mother Earth is objectified like the objectification of woman and treated like a machine made of parts that can be replaced, redesigned, or engineered. That's where we're at. That's really where we're at in this world, where DNA is coded to be edited and deleted. At what point? At the whims of the corporations, where our bodies and engines and food is fuel, where the world is not seen as a complex, interdependent, beautiful and sacred relations. Mm. That's why within our culture, we say, Midakie Owase, we are all related. And that's what I wanted to share with you. Hope this is helpful. The publication is very timely. The world is being promised that these false solutions addressing climate change will eradicate poverty and world hunger, empower our women, address environmental justice issues, and provide funding for just transition and help Indigenous peoples obtain land rights and guarantee our right to free, prior, informed consent. This is not happening. This is a lie. It's a collection of conflicts, contradictions, and lies. Mother Earth is the source of life, which needs to be protected, not a resource to be exploited and commodified as natural capital. We only have one Mother Earth. Let's protect her. Thank you very much.
Merci Cho, thank you. C'est glanet de Denis Planeta, Erils Equi Huche, Durange Betsini Hasi. So thank you so much for having me as a part of this panel discussion today, because as you know, false solutions are, as Tom so eloquently put, they have really inundated the spaces in which state or colonial leaders are really trying to drive climate solutions. And so I'm really glad that this conversation is finally coming to a forefront that is actually has like momentum built around it, that we're now seeing this really broad sector of intersectional movements from, women's groups to Black liberation groups to the Via Campesinas to the Pacific Islanders to all of the different struggles that have been rooted in justice for our people. And justice comes in so many different forms, whether it's like land justice for reparations, whether it's land justice for our communities for getting our land back in North America or Turtle Island, whether it's the movements of fighting against the deeply, deeply entrenched racial discrimination and racism and white supremacy that exists throughout the Americas. We are at this forefront where the climate justice has intersected with everything. And when we talk about justice, we really need to look at what a climate justice framework is. So we were asked, and it kind of didn't happen, but I'm going to read the paragraph because I think this is an important context. So this is in the introduction to Hoodwinked in the Hot House. A climate justice framework does not reduce the climate crisis to a puzzle simply focused on counting carbon. Grassroots, community-led movements around the world look across the economy at the exploitation of land, labor and living systems, at the erosion of seed, soil, story, and spirit, and seek to lift up real solutions around us every day, from indigenous traditional knowledge, food sovereignty, decommodification of land, healthcare and housing, to abolishing the military-industrial complex seeking to extract the last dredge of fossil fuel from Mother Earth. From just transition and energy democracy, where democratized, decentralized, detoxified, and decarbonized energy powers our lives, to transformative justice, where we respond to the violence and trauma with compassion and healing, not policing, punishment, and prisons. I think that when we talk about that and you read that definition of what a climate justice framework looks like, and again, this is in the introduction to the Hoodwinked in the Hot House report, you start to understand that the solutions that are being put forward by colonial governments, whether in the US or so-called Canada or in any of the colonial countries, which is basically all of them at this point, let's be real, that these systems are not holding those at the values. We heard on the historical context that when we talked about early agreements for climate, for addressing the climate crisis in the Kyoto Accord, for example, it reframed. We talked about all of this stuff at the Rio Summit in 1992 about the fact that we need to be talking about seeds and soil and people and humanity and, you know, coming back into relationship with each other and with the land. And that was distorted and skewed into having a conversation that relegated the climate crisis to an economic discussion. And what we're seeing now being driven across the Americas and across the world are false solutions that uphold and support an economy and a system that does little to actually reduce the emissions while safeguarding economic systems, including big corporations and big governments that are in bed with these corporations, to continue to railroad communities, marginalized folks, indigenous peoples, Black communities, and all of the other folks that have been, you know, disempowered and disenfranchised from these systems from the very beginning. So far, you know, there's a lot of these conversations. And as Tom said, we're seeing this repackaging. We're seeing this this appropriation, really, of indigenous ideologies that we have been fighting for and advocating for within these structures to push back against these economic structures, to say that we need to be listening to nature. We've talked about natural law. We've talked about our relationships with Mother Earth. And those have been, again, once again, appropriated, repackaged, and recommodified as nature-based solutions, carbon offsets, blue carbon, all of these different structures that do nothing but continue to commodify the natural world and allow big polluters to keep polluting and allow those that are in power to stay in power and do very little to address the justice frameworks that I just spoke about at the beginning. We need to be looking at ways to recenter ourselves, our relationships, and separate ourselves from this economic structure and remove it out of the conversation. If we are going to address the climate crisis, we cannot do it from an economic perspective. And one of the things that Indigenous Climate Action has been doing over the last couple of years is we've really been looking at how we can begin to unpack what decolonizing climate policy can look like. And so we recently released a report that looked at Canadian climate policy, and it's called Decolonizing Climate Policy in Canada. And it investigated the shortcomings and problems associated with Canadian climate policy while at the same time supporting and developing Indigenous-led climate policy. Climate policies by and for Indigenous people that will raise up and empower Indigenous-led solutions. And this is so important because we have to be looking at deconstructing and the undoing of current systems to create space for our own independent processes and plans that are built around this holistic, interconnected, balanced approach that's based on relationship, reciprocity, and respect for each other and the natural world. And so within that context, like within Canada, you know, we're often looked at as this, you know, sort of nice country, by a lot of folks. But the reality is these same solutions that are being driven forward that we hear about by, you know, the big ugly country, the USA, we're doing the same thing here in Canada, except we package it really, really nicely. With Indigenous peoples and the Indigenous peoples within Canada, the government is parading things around like Indigenous protected and conservation areas as a way to broach both truth and reconciliation by allowing Indigenous peoples to have the ability to manage conservation zones. But those conservation zones are being underwritten by big corporations, Shell, Exxon, Suncor, Syncor. Some of the biggest operators in the tar sands are underwriting these conservation offset programs that they're then going to be using once we have developed a mitigation strategy that they're hoping for that can be utilized not just within Canada as a way to offset their emissions, but within the international systems that are being negotiated at the UN level. And so we have to be very careful about when colonial governments give us or hand us a so-called olive branch as marginalized communities, as disenfranchised communities where the systems were never created for us, or by us, or with us, that when they hand these opportunities for us, what is the hidden agenda? We have to constantly be thinking about what is the hidden agenda behind government suddenly just very like, oh, we want you to manage your lands and territories because it benefits them and it creates the optics that they're doing something. But at the end of the day, the colonial governments still determine which areas become conservation offsets. They would never give the conservation offsets to the Wet'suwet'en clans that have been fighting for the protection of their homelands, even though it is a rich, biodiverse region that deserves just as much conservation and protection as other areas that have been listed in this country. But because it has already been, you know, titled to a corporation for exploitation, it does not get it. So they're only giving what they feel is going to benefit them, the corporation, and the entire system of false solutions to be pushed forward that continues to railroad and marginalize our communities. So we have to move forward and support each other. We have to support each other in this movement for liberation from false solutions and liberation from capitalism, liberation from white supremacy.
We're out of time. I'd like to thank the organizers of the webinar, Hoodwinked in the Hot House, for allowing us to share their audio with you. I would also like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, Romero Funes, our assistant producer, and today's audio engineer. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Remember to visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. And this is your host, Margaret Prescott, and y'all, please remember to stay safe.
This is Julian Joiello, and I'm a listener and supporter of WBAI. I'm a student at NYU, and I live in New York City. And I want to shout out to the other young listeners of WBAI. We have to help keep the station going, and the easiest way to do it is through the WBAI Buddy System. If you donate as little as $10 a month, you have proactively promoted free speech radio. Go to the website, WBAI.org, click the donate button, and make a difference.
Stay tuned for Max Politics with Ben Max here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is now 5.